15114, Jason Sartori versus Julie Schrott.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
Of course. Go right ahead, Mr. Stansky, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Stansky. I represent Mr. Sartori on appeal. The trial court erred by finding that Ms. Schrott had access to Mr. Sartori's Gmail and Skype accounts, that read communication were not stored within the meanings of the SCA, and that Mr. Sartori's claims regarding the CFAA failed because he did not meet the jurisdictional loss requirement.
Can we start with just authorization sort of off the top? You don't contend anymore, I take it, that she had authorization to use the laptop?
That's correct, Your Honor. We do not on appeal argue that she had authorization to access the computer. That's
okay.
Correct, Your Honor.
So now let's talk about Skype.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's her account, correct?
No,
she's not the owner of that account?
No, Your Honor. It's his account, even though she registered it.
She registered it. Did she have the password?
She did.
Okay.
Who created the password?
She did.
Okay. That sounds like hers. I mean, who else is authorized to use that account if not her?
Well, he was obviously authorized because he used it. So she set up the account and then effectively abandoned that account, and he used it. So all of the content, all of the data was his that was on that account.
But still, you're saying that she's not even authorized to come back to it, that somehow like by desuetude or something, she loses the right to use an account that she registered and for which she created the password? She's not even authorized to use that account?
Yes, Your Honor.
She couldn't have used it to communicate with him?
Well, he communicated with her.
Could she have used it to communicate with him?
Taking your hypothetical, you have to assume that there is yet another account that she'd be communicating with. So it doesn't really fit within the facts of this case as far as how she'd be.
There's no internal communication on that Skype account?
No, Your Honor. Okay. No, Your Honor. She had a separate Skype account that she was using for pretty much the relevant periods leading up to when she discovered the things that she discovered on those two accounts. She had her own account that she was using in the United States and the account that she set up on his behalf,
given your client's testimony, you're asking us to rule as a matter of law that no matter what happens between spouses, a spouse who sets up an account purportedly for her husband or his wife, creates the password, can never use that account, notwithstanding the things that your client said about his attempts or non-attempts to exclude her.
Your Honor, I will take part of that. However, I'll point to the appellee's brief that I think laid this out very well, that it is very much context-driven. And so when we're dealing with these matters of family relations, it goes to the context of how those parties conduct themselves to determine authorization or not authorization. And that's something, and as far as interspousal privacy, has been around for a long time. And this court, although this case wasn't cited in the brief, in Glazier v. Glazier, that this court ruled in 2003, acknowledged the fact that there is interspousal privacy within the context, in that case, of the wiretapping statute, and being able to have privacy on the same phone line that both routinely used. So, Mr. Sartori, it was Mr. Sartori's accounts, and by the actions and the conduct of the parties, excluded her authorization from using that account.
What action did Mr. Sartori take after he learned that she accessed a Skype account?
And just to clarify your question, Your Honor, are you talking about on April 6th or April 5th?
Whenever The date of access doesn't really matter to me. What matters to me is when he learned of her accessing the Skype account, what did he do?
Nothing.
That's huge.
Well,
because if you have that interspousal privacy thing in this context, right, then you would expect the aggrieved spouse to say, oh my God, you shouldn't have been doing that. Let me close this account. Let me do something else. Let me change the password. Nothing is done. And of course, the explanation is the cat's out of the bag. But that doesn't matter. The reason is, that explains the reason why he didn't do something, but it doesn't explain going backwards whether or not there was a shared expectation of joint use. As a matter of fact, if it points to anything, it points in the other direction, that it didn't really matter because there was no attempt at the end. I say this charitably. It looks like Mr. Sartori was involved in a number of relationships as this was going on. And before things went south for him, to the extent that he wanted to use a Skype account to continue the same type of behavior, you would have thought that he would have at least closed the account and started a new one on his own, and yet there it is, still there, for her to go back and go into again. I can't speak for my colleagues, but that to me matters. So I'd like you to address it.
Yes, Your Honor. And the three principal cases that we cite to the court, Haitley, Brown Jordan, and Vista Marketing, in every single one of those cases, the defendants had the password. They had the password. In Haitley, there was an awareness that the password could be used to access the accounts. And so the fact that she established, and the she here is Ms. Shrout, established the password and Mr. Sartori didn't change it, does not alleviate what the holding of those three cases are.
But isn't Vista's pretty different, right? I mean, Vista, the so-called hacker or whatever, had to type in a password into her husband's corporate email on her own personal computer, right? Seems pretty different to me.
Yes, I agree with the facts there, Your Honor. However, it was a corporate account that they both set up together. She had used that corporate account while they were still married, and she was an officer of that organization. So again, this connects to
if those were the facts, then maybe that case is wrongly decided. Because if you're telling me that it's a corporate account, both spouses are corporate officers, the hacker sets up the account, sets up the password, gets the password, they both use the account, how can that be unauthorized access? It doesn't get to a lot of the other legal issues with regards to all of these federal acts, but how can that be unauthorized access?
And I'm going to have to fall back again on what is the conduct of the parties involved and what is the context? Because to read Vista and say that it is wrongly decided would create an enormous burden on every single plaintiff. Because moving forward, you're saying, hey, you should have changed your account, or you should have changed your password immediately once you found out that there was something that could have gone awry.
Can we talk about Gmail briefly?
Yes, Sean.
I mean, in all candor, I think Gmail is your better argument than Skype. I don't think Skype's any good, to be honest with you. But on Gmail, is that his account?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it password enabled?
It was password enabled in as much as she did not know what the password was, but under the facts of the case and in the record, the account was signed in. So when she went to Gmail, what popped up was his login data, and all that she had to do was press Gmail and she entered into his inbox.
So he had never signed out.
Correct, Your Honor.
So here's my question. Talk to me about Van Buren.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because in Van Buren, it seems to me the Supreme Court basically says that under the CFAA, what we're concerned about is sort of formal access. And so, you know, sort of Does the existence of a password sort of trigger CFAA scrutiny? Or is it, or in this case, because practically when she pops open the computer, it sort of populates and it's open, is that sort of sufficient access or authorization?
Your Honor, if I could take it in two parts. So to your point as far as Van Bruin addressing the password, I don't believe it does in this context. And I will lean on support the fact that I don't think Van Bruin is activated in this case, because as the Supreme Court mentioned in the majority opinion, that case dealt with the gates up, gates down, or did not deal with the gates up, gates down situation, which is what we have with Mr. Sartori's Gmail.
I thought Justice Barrett specifically said that it is a gates up, gates down scenario.
No, Your Honor, that my understanding of the case is the gates up, gates down relates to the without authorization.
Yes, yeah, so as my recollection is, Justice Barrett says the reason that the government's argument does not work in Van Buren is because if you read A2, the first clause of A2, without authorization, and the second clause of A2, with authorization but exceeding the authorization, or whatever, I'm kind of mangling that, that both of them, she says, should be a gates up, gates down rule. And the government's sort of purpose-driven analysis had a gates up, gates down on the first clause, but not gates up, gates down on the second clause. So she rejects that view.
Yes, Your Honor, but in that context, it goes to once you're in some type of system under CFAA into that database, there needs to be another gate which was not present in the facts of Van Bruin, right?
Right, so what's the gate here? That's my question. What's the gate here? At the program level, at the Gmail level, what's the gate? She opens it up, it's open. So what's the gate? She didn't have to like circumnavigate or hurdle over any gate.
Right, and we are saying that that is no different than her having the password.
This is why I ask you about whether Van Buren is really concerned about sort of formal legal access or practical access.
And I would say both, because again, and I lean on my reading of Van Bruin in this case not to apply, because the gate was down, even though the key was in the lock, if you want to start taking metaphors for this scenario.
Can I ask you one other Gmail-related question, and then I'll leave it alone and let others ask questions, or you to continue. Is the Gmail argument preserved here? Did you make the Gmail argument in your brief?
Your Honor, I appreciate that was brought up in the response brief. I believe it was. It was certainly baked in with all of the authority that we used.
Well, the reason I ask is that at page 8 of your brief, you lay out your arguments. You say, here they are, first, second, third.
Sure.
And the third one says, the lower court erred by ruling because Ms. Schrott registered the Skype account. In controversy, Mr. Sartori's SCA and FCAA's claims failed.
Yes, Your Honor.
So nothing about Gmail.
Yes, Your Honor, and like I said, I would say that it was, and if it's inarticulated in the brief, then that's on me. I see my time has expired.
I have one more question.
May I answer?
Yeah, well, I got to ask it first.
He only gets to ask, you don't get to answer.
So after I ask it, you can say the red light's on, and you told us the beginning when the red light's on, it's over. So, factually.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would your argument be any different on the Gmail account if when she opened it, it populated, and there was only one email at issue, and that email was open, so that she didn't have to, although everything had been accessed, she didn't have to click specific email, like she sees an email from her husband to someone who is presumably a woman and clicks it to open it, but it had already been accessed. But here, when she pops up the computer, hits the little screen to turn it on, the first thing that pops up on the Gmail thing is the email itself, the content. And she just has it there without doing anything else. Does that make any factual difference?
I believe it does. And I think that the only way that you could use these two federal statutes in a fair context would be to allow that. Otherwise, what will end up happening is people inadvertently access the email accounts of somebody else, and then that will trigger liability.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I appreciate the extra time.
Okay, Ms. Smith.
Good morning. May it please the court. I represent appellee Ms. Julie Schroat, and I will begin with why Ms. Schroat was authorized to access the Skype and Gmail accounts and why that means that all of Mr. Sartori's CFAA and SEA claims fail, and the district court's judgment should be affirmed. I understand that the bench may be more concerned with the Gmail account, so I'll start there unless there are questions about Skype. And I do want to emphasize the fourth.
I am less concerned about Skype, and I think Judge Newsom may be as well, but we still have to write an opinion about the Skype issue. So help me with this. Do you need everything that Ms. Schroat did in this case to have authorization? In other words, if you only have half of what she did, would you be in the same place?
Meaning if you...
If she set up the account in every formal way, but told him, okay, slides the computer to him, turns like, put in the password, your password. And then he puts it in and she doesn't see it. And she somehow gets the password somehow later. Are you in the same position?
I don't think so, Your Honor, okay. Because here it's that she created the account using the credentials and the personal information that the family regularly used for family accounts, and so she had the password because...
And she inputted.
And yes, she created the account using the password that then she used to access the account.
So you need the whole gestalt, the whole group of things that happen here.
In the sense that mere access to a password is not enough. As in Haitley, if the access to the password is unauthorized.
Understanding her creation of the account physically.
I guess the creation of the account physically does suggest that she's the account owner, but I think the fact, if she's not creating the password, that would change the authorization issue.
Who is the account titled for?
It may be a joint account under those circumstances.
No,
in this circumstance, I think if the account belonged to any one person, it was Ms. Schroat.
But does, I don't have Skype. I don't use it. But when you register a Skype account, do you register a name or just an email address? Do you have to put in username and then also put in an email address and then a password too?
Yes, you would have a username. And, you know, I'm not sure in the record here what the username for the account is. But again, I believe that Ms. Schroat created the account using the username and password that the family regularly uses.
For all of their computers.
That's right, Your Honor.
Did you have a question?
All right, so let's talk Gmail.
Okay, let's talk Gmail. So to start, I do want to point out that Judge Newsom is correct that the Gmail authorization issue is forfeited in the opening brief, and the forfeiture is underscored by scanning the issue statements and the headings. And of course, we raised the forfeiture issue on pages 13 and 18 of our response brief, and Mr. Sartori was entitled to file a reply. Indeed, he requested an extension of time to do so, and this court granted that extension, and he chose not to file a reply, which transformed the forfeiture into a waiver. So the court could affirm as to the Gmail account on that basis alone. In any case, Ms. Schroat was authorized to access the Gmail account on both April 5th and May 6th because, as you can see from Appendix 151 and 85 through 86, it is undisputed that she simply typed in gmail.com on the computer that she shared with her then husband from their bedroom, and Mr. Sartori's emails popped up.
So can you help me with this fixation I've developed, frankly, this morning with Van Buren and the difference between what I'm calling practical sort of sheer dumb luck access, which is what we have here, and sort of entitlement access? Because the Van Buren court does talk a lot about access and how in sort of computational language, the court says, that means sort of entitlement. I guess I'm wondering, like, if the Gmail account is his, like the Skype was hers, and it has a password that is she, like, entitled to use that? I mean, I get it that under the facts here, she didn't have to, like, circumnavigate any code barrier, but is what the court's talking about in Van Buren sort of legal access, entitlement, or practical access?
I understand the court to be talking about a gates up, gates down inquiry, and here there was no gate down because when she typed in gmail.com from the computer that she shared with her then husband, his emails popped up. And there's no difference, which I think Judge Jordan's last hypothetical to my colleague was getting at, between her authorization to access the inbox homepage by typing in gmail.com and her authorization to access particular emails. And that's because in Van Buren, the court explains that for Ms. Schroed or someone to have exceeded authorized access, that means that there's a file folder or database within the computer where there's a gates down inquiry, where they would be a hacker if they were accessing.
How about attachments to the emails? If you go one step further and then start downloading those two and accessing those two, you're in the same place or a different place?
The same place. You're authorized to access those attachments because there's no gates down barrier in that circumstance, and you haven't hacked into the account, which is what the CFAA is designed to protect
against. I think I'm sort of inclined to agree with you, but I continue to be sort of plagued by this language in Van Buren that talks about, like, you know, access, meaning whether one lacks access privileges. And they talk about entitlement. I think they cite dictionaries saying that that means that one has a title, right, or claim to something. And if one isn't the passport author or holder, author or holder, then do you really have, like, a right to be in there, or is it just that you got in there?
I think you are authorized to be in there, and it's not a crime to access the account. And I'd point the court to this court's decision in Snow versus DirecTV that says for an account to be protected by the SEA and the CFAA, the website must be configured in some way so as to limit ready access. And that's because the statute is designed to protect against hacking. It's not designed to criminalize everyday access to unprotected computers. And so in this context, it makes sense that no court has ever held that viewing a spouse's emails on a shared computer violates the CFAA or the SEA. And here, Ms. Schroed did not guess a password or circumvent any software barriers. Instead, she typed in gmail.com on her computer.
But that argument, it doesn't go quite as far as I think your last statement suggests, because if you have a shared computer but different Gmail accounts, different passwords, and the spouses don't share the password with each other, and I know your username, but I guess your password after I keep trying it for a month and I finally hit on the password and open it, that's unauthorized.
That's right, Your Honor. And here Ms. Schroed did not guess a password. And as the district court observed...
It's not just shared computer.
That's right, Your Honor. It's not just the shared computer.
It has to be that you did not do something to get into a place where you shouldn't have been.
The importance of the shared computer, though, goes to that Mr. Sartori had to know that on this computer that Ms. Schroed used for everyday activities, that she might type in gmail.com, and therefore her access to gmail.com was authorized because he failed to log out of his account. And once Mr. Sartori's emails popped up, she was authorized to open his emails. And Ms. Schroed's May 6th access to the Gmail account was lawful for all of these same reasons, but also because, as the district court held, Ms. Schroed had Mr. Sartori's implied consent to access the account again. At Appendix 186, we see the district court citing Mr. Sartori's deposition, where he testified that he wasn't worried at all about Ms. Schroed having any additional access or anything like that after she initially accessed the accounts, because at that point, in Mr. Sartori's words, the cat was already out of the bag. And again, at that point, Mr. Sartori had every reason to believe that Ms. Schroed would access the account again, yet he did not change his password or even log out of the account. And if there are no further questions about authorization, I would like to move directly to the SEA electronic storage question and rest on our brief and our 28J letter as to the CFAA loss issue. And turning to the electronic storage question, Ms. Schroed also did not violate the SEA because she read only copies of Mr. Sartori's opened emails, which were not held to support transmission and were thus not in electronic storage. To start, electronic storage must mean something different from just storage, because the statute provides tiered privacy protections in sections 2703A and B for two different types of stored data held by a provider. The first type of data is held in electronic storage. That is, in our view, copies of messages incidental to transmission and backup copies of messages that support transmission in the event that the system crashes before transmission is completed. And the second type of data is data that an account holder chooses to leave in long-term storage with a remote computing service provider, and this data does not support transmission. And Congress created this essential distinction because it was building on federal law like the Wiretap Act.
Can I ask you just a quick question to make sure I'm following along with your statutory analysis? So I think we've put subsection A to the side, right? And we're talking about subsection B. Any storage of such communication by an electronic communication service for purposes of backup protection. Are you presently talking about, I've sort of broken this down into three subparts, such communication by an electronic communication service for purposes of backup protection. Which of those kind of three subparts are you talking about presently? I just want to make sure I'm following you.
So for purposes of backup protection.
Got it.
For that language to have meaning, it must mean something different than any storage. Otherwise, Part B would just say any storage of a wire or electronic communication. But in that sense, I'm also talking about the phrase such communication, referring back to all of Part A. And then, of course, the phrase electronic communication service helps us as well, because in our view, and as this court explained in Vista Marketing, whether a particular copy is held by an electronic communication service is determined by the context and looking to that specific copy.
But you don't have to have, do you, either the argument that such communication refers back to A, you don't have to have that, and you don't have to have that this is a remote computing service as opposed to an electronic communication service if you can get me on for purposes of backup storage.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. And so do I understand correctly, and I'll just confess that I'm kind of an ignoramus with this stuff, but do I understand correctly that with these web-based services, it's kind of like everything is simultaneously a copy and an original? Like there is no kind of hierarchy among the real thing and copies, and is that why none of these things are being stored for purposes of backup? Or have I kind of missed it?
Your Honor, I think that you may be referring to some of the reasoning in Haitley that suggests that because email is redundant today and it's hard to distinguish between the original copy and the backup copy, somehow nothing is protected under Part B as a backup.
Well, it's either that like nothing is protected
or everything is protected.
Right.
Yes, and I think Haitley's solution to this problem is to suggest in footnote 5 that, well, perhaps everything can just be protected under Part B, and that would mean that everything would receive the warrant process rather than the subpoena process. But the problem with that is that Congress wanted to take a tiered approach. It was striking a balance between individual privacy protections and government access to that data. And so if everything is covered by the warrant process, then nothing. The government can never use the subpoena process, but also the Fourth Circuit simply fails to give meaning to the phrase for purposes of backup protection, and it just leaves the statute reading as any storage for purposes of storage.
So is there something between the Fourth Circuit solution that everything is for backup purposes, and is your contention that nothing is for backup purposes on a Gmail type device or account?
No, Your Honor. Our contention is that there is a copy of the message that is protected under Part A. It's the copy that's incidental to transmission. And there's a copy of the message that supports transmission and is a backup copy in the event of a server crash. But it's not the copy that ultimately is sent to the recipient's server. And therefore, it's not protected under Part A.
So maybe it's that my premise is sort of wrong, that you can't distinguish among the copies. You're saying, in fact, you can. There's one that even maybe not in an Outlook sense, but is sort of like local-ish. And then there are others that are bouncing around in the ether.
To the service provider. Are you speaking of the copy that's protected under Part A that eventually reaches the recipients?
May not be making any sense.
Recipients.
I'm just trying to get my head around it.
Okay. Yes, our contention is that the copies protected under Part B are copies that support transmission because they're held by the service provider's server in the event of a server crash or some other problem.
So theoretically, under And I know even less than Judge Newsom does, so it's more dangerous for me to even ask.
It's a low bar, my friend.
So that if you had a really sophisticated hacker who knew where to get to that copy that was for backup protection, you'd have coverage under the subsection.
So in any event, you'd have coverage under the CFAA.
I know, but
okay.
I'm talking about the Stored Communications Act.
So you're suggesting a sophisticated hacker who accesses...
I am trying to get around the technology. And
yes.
I really haven't been very successful.
Yes.
So I didn't even worry about it this morning like Judge Newsom did.
Yes.
You say that there is, in the universe mm-hmm. of this technology, a copy
yes.
for backup protection that exists.
Yes.
Okay, it's out there somewhere.
Right.
If you had a sophisticated hacker who knew how to access that copy
yes.
and got to that copy, you would have a potential violation of that subsection.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would just emphasize...
And so maybe that's the middle ground, although it may be a middle ground that is almost physically or practically impossible to get to, but at least statutorily, that's a potential way to read the provision to have at least some content and some meaning.
It's theoretical in that context when we're talking about a hacker, but again, that's because the CFAA protects against hacking regardless of whether the communications are open or closed.
Don't use hacker then. Don't limit, use my lack of sophistication. Use any user who might
trigger this protection. So I would use instead the government seeking access to that data, whether they have to
proceed. Assuming the government never hacks.
Whether they have to proceed under the warrant process or the subpoena process. That's the concern, that these copies do exist in backup protection with the service provider, and that if we don't give the language for the purposes of backup protection any meaning, then the government can routinely make requests of providers using just a subpoena instead of the warrant process.
Okay.
And just to sum up, the district court's judgment should be affirmed because Ms. Schroedt was authorized to access the Skype and Gmail accounts, and the authorization issue does resolve this case entirely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matthew. Okay, Mr. Stansky, you've got your rebuttal time left.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did want to just address something in Haitley just to add to the conversation, because I believe it was missed in the interaction that you had with counsel a few moments ago. Haitley is distinguished by the network architecture from this case. So in Haitley, although Google was the main internet service provider, the local college hosted the emails. And as part of the feature of that that hosting, a copy was sent to what the council and court referred to as the vault. And so this was a communication or a server that was held and controlled by the Virginia College system that allowed the students, if for some reason they lost access or whatever, to get access to those emails. And so that is significant in this case because that separate vault doesn't matter. A backup copy is a backup copy. And so in Haitley, the counsel for the defendants tried to distinguish between the purpose and the use, basically saying, hey, look, there's a backup copy for the user and there's a backup copy for Google. And so Haitley, in his opinion, as we read it, eliminated those distinctions. And the backup copy, it does not matter who the beneficiary is.
So can you just explain to me sort of in plain language that I'll understand why it was that the email that Ms. Schroedt accessed was stored for purposes of backup protection?
Because it is a backup copy.
Is every copy a backup copy in Gmail on your reading?
Yes. Because I'm sorry to cut you off, Your Honor, as you noted, there's no way to know, especially when we have the circumstance that we have here where people, Ms. Schroedt in this case, accessed a web-based web-based application. And so we do not know whether that was the backup copy or the subsequent backup copy or whichever copy it was.
So, to the other side's point, the government's always got to go through the warrant process, never the subpoena process, on Gmail?
Yes. Okay. I see my time expired. We ask the court to reverse.
Thank you both very much. If you prevail, you need to call your U.S. senator and tell him you want to be a U.S. district judge, because we're going to need about 100 more in the 11th Circuit. Our last case this morning is number 20.